very much for inviting me here to give this presentation. I will try to make it less technical to the extent I can do it and more just presenting a general picture. You see the title is The Second Mission of Supersymmetry, which of course assumes that there is the first mission. Therefore, before I switch my focus to the second mission, I will have to briefly explain to you what was the first mission. And in general, I want to start with a, maybe we'll spend 5 minutes to a general introduction of the role of supersymmetry in the general picture of quantum science as it emerged since 1920s after the discovery of quantum mechanics. So here I present this quantum tree, just the way it develops, developed and is still developing. At the very bottom you see 1920s, it's the invention of quantum mechanics by Bohr, Heisenberg and Schrödinger and others. And then it started rapidly growing, and the first three branches which split from quantum mechanics were condensed matter, quantum field theory, and nuclear physics. And these three basic branches, they gave the entire tree which we see today, and of course it grew enormously, many, many branches. I couldn't even depict all of them, as well as it is very hard to depict interconnections between them. You see, I tried to depict some little bridges, but in fact, everything is entangled very much. Each branch has many connections with the other branch. And let me quickly say what happens with condensed matter. It's probably the most fruitful branch, which is flourishes and blossoms today, continue developing in a very rapid pace. You see it's all green. It gave rise to quantum chemistry, to material sciences, to modern nanophysics, to strong correlation models and materials, strong correlated materials. Now we see a rapidly growing another branch, which goes under the name of quantum computing. It's still in its infancy, but it grows very rapidly, topological insulators and other materials, and it's all in the transition period with many, many achievements occurring, well, let's say yearly or maybe monthly. Now, another branch which was developing rapidly, but unfortunately, it's not so much now. It was nuclear physics. You see, it appears, the first papers on nuclear physics appeared in 1930. One of the influential nuclear physicists who was, Niels Bohr himself started the nuclear physics and developed many crucial elements. And then people like Plachek, like Piles and associates, other associates of Niels Bohr, they developed it. During the war, nuclear physics had a branch of nuclear technology associated with the development of the nuclear weapons. And after the war, it gave scientific research in nuclear physics faded away. It gave rise to particle physics, which started using accelerators of exceedingly higher energies. But then particle physics branched here. I put it on the right. And given the modern status of accelerator physics, I think it's more or less hit dead end, because the only remaining accelerator in operation is at CERN, LHC. It has some plans for the next 10, 15 years, but the energies, the intensity will increase somewhat, the energies will be the same, and there are some bad expectations or anti-hopes that there will be nothing new discovered there in this, at this accelerator. So it will remain in our memory as the discoverer of Higgs, which is very important for the completion of the standard model. But unfortunately, it doesn't take us out of the standard model or beyond the standard model. Well, so particle physics gave rise in turn to high energy physics, which is broader than particle because it includes non-accelerator experiments. For instance, solar neutrinos, astroparticle physics, and stuff like that. And it has some other branches. Of them, I will mention supersymmetry, which developed in the early 70s as a part of high energy physics. Supergravity also developed as a part of probably even particle physics. And string theory started developing after the Veneziano formula, the very late 1960s, early 1970s. Okay, and now the third branch is quantum field theory, and here crucial people were Pauli, Heisenberg, and a couple of other people. For instance, Pasquale Jordan was close to Heisenberg. Probably you didn't hear his name. Don't hear his name that much in connection of quantum field theory, but he was among the very pioneers. And why you didn't hear only little about him, I emphasize his name is Jordan, not Jordan. Jordan would be American or British pronunciation, but he was German. So J in German is Y. That's because when Nazi came to power, he became an ardent Nazi. And basically stopped doing any. He joined the army and worked for the military. And then after the war, he had to go through the process of denazification. And he was very close to being put into prison, but Pauli saved him literally from that. He was forbidden to teach at the universities, and then he became a politician. So that's why his name, I mean, mathematicians know Jordan algebra, so that's about it. Okay, quantum field theory grew, and there was kind of a new rebirth of quantum field theory in the 1970s with the advent of the Young-Mills theories, asymptotic freedom, supersymmetric theories appeared at this time. And you see that this branch still flourishing. Now interest shifted to quantum field theories at strong coupling. And then there are interconnections between quantum field theory and string theory and mathematical physics. This is the branch of string theory, which continue more or less to contribute to this theory. It's called swampland. I'm not going to explain to you what it means. Okay, this is more or less general picture of what grew of two or three papers in the 1920s right here. Now, only supersymmetry, if you punch supersymmetry on spires, only supersymmetry in the title only will give you more than 30,000 papers. And there is also supergravity, string theory. So you see it's a huge, almost practically an industry.
That is post-empirical science.
Excuse me?
What is mushroom?
Mushroom is post-empiric science. It's a bad thing which happened to our science. I don't want to waste my time, but if you want to ask me after colloquium in private, I can tell you everything about that. Okay, so now I come to supersymmetry. The entire 20th century, the highest achievement of the 20th century is usually mentioned is the relativity theory due to Einstein. And this formula in a wrong form, it became a cultural icon of the 20th century. Usually people do not add this subscript E naught, and they write just on every t-shirt you see that E equal to mc squared, which is totally wrong because mass is a constant and energy is not constant. We can put any energy into a material object. So you cannot have an equality between a varying quantity like E and the mass times mc squared. So I put here E sub naught, making it clear that this is rest energy. If you imply that this is the rest energy, then the formula becomes correct. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, in the 1970s, something else happened in the theory of the scale, I believe, as important, at least theoretically. Theoretical scale of this discovery, I believe, is as important as the discovery of the Einstein's relativity. That's because this discovery, in fact, implied that our space-time is much richer when they think. You see, in Einstein's special relativity, there are, in general, in nature, there are very few conserved quantities of geometrical nature. What does it mean, geometrical? It means that related to geometry of the space-time. Basically, it's energy, momentum, and orbital momentum. Okay? That's all. And for many, many years, people believe that this conservation of this, for instance, energy is related to time translation, so momentum to space translations. And people believed for decades that that's all we can have in our world. In 1970, it was realized that, in fact, we can supplement these conservation laws by number of other conservation laws, also of geometrical nature. And the generators of this for these new conserved quantities are called the supercharges. Here I wrote the they're of quantum nature, they are fermions. That's why they were overlooked. They have been overlooked for decades because we don't see them in the classical world. These are two, in four dimensions, the minimal number of supercharges is four, two complex Qs and two complex Q conjugates. And their anti-commutator produces is proportional to the energy momentum vector. So the energy momentum vector is conserved, and so then so do have these supercharges to be conserved too. So in four dimensions, as I mentioned, the minimal supersymmetry is called n equal 1. It has four supercharges. You can extend supersymmetry, for instance, doubling the number of supercharges, making them 8. Then this is referred to n equal 2 supersymmetry. Okay, and some people believe that this will become the icon of the 21st century, but this statement has to be deferred, and I will explain why. So far, it's not the icon of the 20th cultural icon of the 21st century. Now, I pass to a few words on the history, how supersymmetry in four dimensions was discovered. The starting point for these two gentlemen, here you see Yuri Golfand and Yevgeny Lichman. He was a student of Golfand at that time, early 70s, or at the, you see, November 70, March 71. That's the date of the publication of the their first paper, and that's the date where they finished it. There are a few months, dormant months, because in Soviet Union, everything published had to be approved by a branch of KGB, which was called Glavlit, and usually it took 4, 5, 6 months. So this few months, the paper was in a dormant state. Now, they started from the Coleman-Mandula theorem. What is the Coleman-Mandula theorem? It's exactly the theorem which stated what I explained on the previous picture, that in four dimensions, any non-trivial field theory with S matrix, which is unitary and is not equal to unity, any non-trivial theory can have only four symmetries, four conservation laws: energy, total energy, and total moment. And this was proven at the mathematical level in this theorem by Coleman-Mandula, late 60s. So for some reasons which are beyond my comprehension, this Lichtman-Golfen decided to that this is not possible. There should be a loophole in this theorem. And indeed, within 2 years, he with his student discovered the extension of the Poincaré algebra. But the loophole in the Coleman-Mandula argument was that they only considered with the generators with spin 1 or 2 integer spins. They didn't consider any half integer spins among the set of generators. So Golfand assumed that there may be integer spins generators, and then he managed to close the algebra by including four extra supercharges. The algebra closes in the sense that Q bar and Q anti-commute to give energy momentum, but the commutation laws, let's say with the Lorentz rotation operators, are exactly such as is needed for spinners. Not only they invented this super algebra for the first time, they also worked out an explicit four-dimensional model. This was the model, it's not written here for some reason. It's here, no. They wrote out explicitly super Young-Mills, I'm sorry, super quantum electrodynamics, that is electron is electron, photon and fotina with interactions, and even for completeness, they added a mass term to the photon and fotina, because in abelian theories, you can add it consistently. There is no problem in having massive photon. In supersymmetry makes it fotina. This is a very painful work because they didn't know any of the modern methods of developing supersymmetric theories, but still they managed to do it. The paper, as I mentioned, was published March 10, 71. Oh no, it was received in a journal and published in April 71. So the next interesting development from my perspective, no, this not the next. There was an immediate development, independent development shortly after, which on the next slide. But I should mention an important algebraic development due to these people, Haak, Lopushansky, and Sonius. They started checking super algebra. In a sense, they posed a question. Is the superalgebra written by Golfand and Lichtman, or even its extensions to Enochund, is it complete? Are there any other possibilities for closed algebras with supercharges? And they, in 1974, they found out that, first of all, Some of the commutators can include just constants on the right-hand side, which necessarily commute with all other generators of the super Poincaré group. These constants are called central charges, and the only they believed, как Лопушанский и Сониус, that central charges should be only Lorentz scalars because they should commute with everything else in the super Poincaré algebra. I hasten to add that now it's not so. I mean, this is extended, but they were searching only for the Lorentz scalar supercharge, and then they discovered that in n equal one, in the minimal superalgebra, they cannot be possible, just on the Lorentz grounds. And then they figured out that if you extend superalgebra with n equal two with eight supercharges, you see now here you have alpha and beta, and I is the flavor, so to say. I and j is one, two, so you have eight supercharges. I point out here this in the basic superalgebra, it's q bar, and here it took u's. And then Lorentz invariance allows to write here something with z of the Lorentz invariant type, you see, through the Levi-Civita tensors. That's because you see this is anti-commutator. It has to be symmetric under simultaneous interchanges I and j. So that was the first central charge, Haag, Lopushansky, and Sonius. Haag and Lopushansky have unfortunately died. Sonius left physics long ago. Another interesting remark that refers to the so-called device or trick, which goes under the name Bogomolny completion. And Bogomolny completion is as follows. Assume you have a theory. So in some theory, you can represent the action of the theory in any number of dimensions, and it can be any theory. But assume you can represent this theory as a sum of the terms of this type. Let's say one term. It is a term which is modulus squared of some combination of the fields plus topological term. Not every theory allows this representation, but many practically important theories do allow this representation. This was invented in 1976, and Bogomolny was my friend and colleague. We shared an office. And I was I knew what he was doing. At that time, it didn't seem that important, but pretty soon it appeared to be a very important development. The next step here was De Vega and Shaposhnik, also at that time young people, who noted that if a theory allows this representation as modulus squared of something, then this theory can be elevated. You can add some fermions to the theory and it becomes supersymmetric. Any theory, and now we know that vice versa too, every supersymmetric theory would allow this representation. So the whole thing is called, this device is called Bogomolny completion. Oops. Sorry. Now, the next step in the development of supersymmetry was, of course, due to Wess and Zumina. Due to Wess and Zumina, 1973 and later, they were at CERN. So after they went from a totally different directions, they didn't ask themselves about supersymmetry. They were trying to generalize gauge transformation, to make them bigger, you know, to add some fermion-Grassmann parameters in the gauge transformation. And that's how they came to supersymmetry. And then they almost immediately published a paper on super young Mills, which of course Wolfand and Lippmann couldn't do because of technical difficulties. In general, what supersymmetry means, like super young Milses, you know, the theory of gluons and gluinos. And in general, supersymmetry means that every bosonic state is supplemented, is accompanied by a fermionic state with all quantum numbers are the same except spin. Spin differs by 1/2. So Wess and Zumina at that time were at CERN, and there were a lot of young people around who were hungry to do something new. So these young people started, they actually fought with each other for problems from Wess and Zumina. So this was an explosive development. Now I only say what Wess and Zumina didn't consider. They didn't consider the central charges. Without central charges, we know that if there is a conserved supercharge acting on vacuum, it produces zero, which automatically implies that the vacuum energy density vanishes. This, by the way, was noted even before Wess and Zumina in Lichtman's paper. And then supercharge acting on bosonic states creates a fermionic states of the same mass and quantum numbers, and vice versa. Supercharge acting on fermionic states creates a bosonic state. Now, this equation, this latter equation, changes in case you have a supercharge, Z, which is not equal to zero. And I remind you that all supercharges are of topological nature. Then out of, let's say, four supercharges, usually you can construct a combination, let's say, of two supercharges, I call it Q tilde, which is acting on a certain state, creates zero. And this state S is not vacuum. It is only possible if your superalgebra contains the central charges. And then if so, then the mass of this object has to be exact to the central charge, and the central charge in many, many cases can be calculated exactly, even at strong kappa. So it's a totally new notion in four-dimensional interacting, highly non-trivial field theories, that you can calculate at least some quantities. At strong coupling, you can calculate them exactly. This never happened before. Never ever in the, starting from the very beginning of field theory, which occurred, as I said, early 1930s until mid 1970s for 40 something years. Only in some two-dimensional theories, which are exactly solvable because of infinitely many conservation laws, exact results were known. This was the first ever statement that exact results are possible in four dimensions if there are central charges in the superalgebra. So this is a peak photos of Wess and Zumina approximately at that time, maybe a little later. An important addition to their work was due to Salam Astradi in 1975. He reinterpreted the Wess-Zumina developments in terms of explicit geometry. They added to our usual axes, time, x, y, and z, four axes of the Einstein special relativity. They added extra axes, which are described by Grassmann numbers. So they are purely quantum. Theta squared is equal to zero. And they learn how to describe these extra dimensions in our space in such a way, through superfields, in such a way that construction of supersymmetric model became a triviality. Today, any undergrad students, in principle, who start field theory can do that. Okay, now that's the end of the first introductory part. So what was the first mission of supersymmetry as it was formulated in 1982 paper by Edward Witten? Well, at that time, people still believed in natural knowledge. What was naturalness? That meant that all parameters in the model, and at that time it was only the standard model, should appear naturally. In the sense, you know that people usually believe that the only fundamental scale in the world is the Planck mass. And the masses of the particles we observe in the world in which I live are much, 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 much lower than the Planck mass. So they have to be protected from radiative correction, which would otherwise drag them onto the Planck scale. The fermions are naturally more or less protected from such a disaster because of chiralities, because they can be left-handed and right-handed. The mass only mixes left-handed and right-handed, the radiative corrections are logarithm. And logarithm even of the Planck scale, let's say divide Planck scale by one GV, and times the coupling constant, which is usually much less than one, it's not such a big correction. But the boson mass are quadratically divergent. And therefore, if you start calculating even the first loop correction, it immediately drags it to the Planck scale. And out of all fundamental bosons in the standard model is only one, the Higgs particle. Now we know its mass, it's 100 something GeV, 120. And this bothered not only Witten, but many other people. But Witten published a very influential paper which says if we have supersymmetry, which is broken only at low energy scales, supersymmetry will automatically protect the mass of the Higgs bosons because the loops with fermions in this mass will cancel the loop with bosons in this mass, and the Planck scale will never appear in the radiative correction. So this was the beginning of the storm or tornado, if you wish. And people started believing, they developed what is now what was called minimal supersymmetric standard model or MSSM. Needless to say, it predicts doubling of the whole spectrum. Neutrino has a neutrino, photon has a photina, quark has quark, and so on. There are We have to double each and every species, superpartners, introduce superpartners to what we see in our world. You see, this is our world particles, this is their superpartners. And then, of course, the number of free parameters in the model jumps. In the standard model, there are about 20 free parameters, like mixing angle, mass parameters, and so on. If you just generalize supersymmetrically the standard model in the most minimalistic way, you immediately get over 100 parameters. So it's a model with, even if R parity is conserved. So it's a model with a huge number of adjustable parameters. So what happened with this first mission of supersymmetry? People believed and prayed and believed that superpartners, because it was known in which energy scale superpartners should appear, should be detected in nature in order to provide protection for the Higgs mass. And it was in the TeV scale. So one of the strongest motivation for construction of LHC in its proposal, it was written, and in fact, people worked very hard to discover super partners and the TeV scale, maybe up to 10 TeV, okay? For many years already. And unfortunately, nothing came up. Not a single new particle or new phenomenon, except for the discovery of the Higgs particle. So in this sense, at LHC, the mission was not accomplished, on the contrary. And why, on the contrary, that's because in the foreseeable future, I don't anticipate an accelerator with higher energies, let's say by a factor of 10, which start checking this superparticle in, let's say, up to 100 TeV range. It's very expensive, and it has to build only through global effort, but I don't think that current political situation on our globe allows such a global mission. So in the next probably 20 years, there will be no new big project of this type. And the first mission of supersymmetry to provide stabilization for the Higgs mass is not accomplished. Okay. Also, of course, because people got very upset with the failure of this first mission, the very notion of naturalness is now is questioned. Many people now believe that naturalness is not the basic element of the world design. Maybe the Higgs mass is somehow accidentally at this point. People invoke anthropic principle for that, but this need not concern us as a physical, because anthropic principle is philosophical religion. Okay, whether it is there or not there, one can believe it is there, one can say no, it is not there. There is no way to check it anyway. So, but this way or that way, so far people believe that maybe naturalness is not necessary to explain by low energy supersymmetry. In the sense, if you look now at the current publication, the number of papers devoted to model building in this direction decreased dramatically, maybe at least by an order of magnitude, maybe much more. So at this, I will leave my first mission. I have only 25 minutes left for my conversation, for my talk, and I will pass to the second mission of supersymmetry, which emerged approximately simultaneously with Witten's paper, but was not did not attract too much attention previously, but now it grows rather rapidly. So I want young people to know into that, because it's extremely exciting, extremely interesting, and what is even more important, there are many new results which still could be obtained. So what was the idea? The idea was, through supersymmetry, to obtain exact results in quantum field theory at strong coupling. As I mentioned, strong coupling field theory, even now it's like a black box. Nobody really knows how to work with a generic strongly coupled field theory. But now there is a hope that starting at least from supersymmetric theory of various degree of supersymmetry, you can obtain some interesting exact results, and then if you are lucky, you may decrease the degree of supersymmetry and almost get something useful for non-supersymmetric strongly coupled field theory. So the strategy is as follows. One uses superalgebra with central charges. Now they are called, or some people call them, brain charges. I will explain why. In conjunction with holomorphy and singularities known from general principle. I will explain shortly why holomorphy comes into play if you have central charges in the superalgebra. The first examples of this type appeared in 1983. The first example was the exact beta function in super young Mills, or super young Mills with arbitrary matter. By exact, I mean so all orders in the coupling constant, just exact. And it's extensively used today. And the next exact calculation, approximately maybe a couple of years later, was the calculation of the Gliina condensate in super young Mills. It was shown using this method that in super young Mills, the Gliina lambda is Gliina field in super young Mills, and the condensate of lambda squared is equal to some exactly calculable constant. It's something like 6 times the number of colors. times lambda cube, where lambda is the scale parameter of this theory. So the first calculation of a static quantity of the vacuum in strongly coupled field theory. This is mid-80s. Now the next serious breakthrough occurred due to this gentleman, Natty Zyberg, Edward Witten, in 1994, who did much more. They developed this strategy to incredible heights, I would say. Basically, what they did, let me quickly reply, they used also a theory with a central charge, exactly the same theory and exactly the same central charge, which was discovered by Hagel, Pushansky, and Sonius. In order to have central charge without Lorentz indices, you have to have n equal to supersymmetry, 8 supercharges. And then in this anti-commutator, you can have a constant on the right-hand side, which is of the proper Lorentz structure. And this constant is relevant to the monopoles. I will show a little later one, why it is, or illustrate at least, is relevant to the monopoles. So they explored a cousin of QCD, a supersymmetric theory with 8 supercharges, which for SU2, in this theory, automatically, what occurs automatically, SU2 symmetry is broken down to U1. So two out of three gauge bosons acquire masses, and one remains massless. So it's like the bosonic sector of this model is exactly Georgi Glashow model, in which Polyakov and Hoft in the 1970s discovered the fundamental Tkov-Polyakov monopole. One massless gauge boson, which remains, can be interpreted as a photon. So the magnetic, there is a soliton with a magnetic field emanating from it in a Coulomb-like manner. So it's a magnetic monopole in this theory. Now, using holomorphy, which I will still have to discuss, and using various analytic properties, what this gentleman mentioned to do, there are some free parameters in this theory. I won't make it more detailed. They discovered that when some of these parameters are complex, when you change them analytically at some place in the complex plane, you discover a certain singularity, and this singularity only can be explained by the fact that the monopoles become light. I remind you that they never can become light in the Tkov-Polyakov approximation, because the Tkov-Polyakov monopoles are obtained at weak coupling in the quasi-classical approximation, and that means that they are much heavier than W bosons. They are very heavy. In any environment like this, the Tkov-Polyakov monopole is very heavy. Now, what was demonstrated by Zyberg and Polyakov, that if you start changing parameters on the model, making it more and more strongly coupled, at a certain point in these parameters, monopole become light, or zero, become exactly, have a mass which exactly vanishes. And then they argued that if mass exactly vanish for massless particles, it may be possible to organize them to condense in the vacuum. Okay? To this end, they added a slight deformation of n equal 2 theory down to n equal 1, and indeed saw that the monopoles, they saw that the monopoles condense, and then they used this fact when the monopoles condense, the electric flux tube forms automatically. Because the electric flux cannot be screened, it's monopoles that condense. It cannot be screened and cannot disappear on the way. So you have a charge and anti-charge. There is obviously an electric flux tube between them. And that's confinement, right? A little bit different confinement. Why different? Because it confines electric charges rather than color charges. But it is still a confinement for the first time ever obtained from the first principles, confinement of works. In a sense, this is, they also found a flux tube or a vortex string, which connects these confined charged objects, probe objects, and up to a change of electric, up to duality transformation, changed everything electric into everything magnetic. It turned out to be exactly the abre course of flux tube found in the 50s, which develops between a heavy probe. Abre course of flux tube develops between North magnetic pole and south magnetic pole immersed in the superconductor. And superconductor, it's electric Cooper pairs which condense. So monopole are confined through this tube, abre course of tube. And in the case of Zyberg and Witten, they managed to make condensed monopoles. So they found the electric tube, which was a great achievement. And also the methods they extended were very important. So now I will briefly remind you now that it turned out that the central charges need not to be Lorentz scalars. At first, Hagel, Pochansky, and Sonius believed that they do, but in fact, the most important thing that is that they appear in the superalgebra, like for instance here on the right-hand side. They can still carry Lorentz indices, but they should be arranged in such a way that the commutator of these central charges, let's say with Lorentz rotation, is performed in the standard way. For instance, this is antisymmetric tensor, so the Lorentz rotation should act on this antisymmetric tensor as it acts on any antisymmetric tensor. They are still topological, and there are two types of new extra supercharges. This is antisymmetric tensor with two indices. It is important for domain walls. It is saturated for domain walls. Domain walls are not particles. They are extended objects of codimension one. And the corresponding certain charge, this was discovered by Dvalli and myself in 96, that this, why people didn't consider these charges before? You see, 96 and 75, 20 years, nobody ever thought about these central charges. That's because they don't appear at the classical level. This is a quantum anomaly. And for some reasons, people didn't bother to look into the quantum anomalies. If you start calculating only three graphs, you never get such an object on the right-hand side. You would get just zero. But if you regularize carefully your calculation, let's say in the UV or in any other way through Schwinger splitting, you will discover that in one loop there is this central charge. In correspondence with this logic, one can find two combinations of these supercharges, which acts trivially on domain wall, annihilate it, and then for this combination, what enters on the right-hand side is T wall minus Z. Z is calculable exactly. And therefore, you can calculate the tension of the wall in the exact form. Although it's super Young-Mills, it's strongly coupled theory. Here I depicted this wall. You see In SUN super young mills, there are N distinct degenerate vacua, as everybody knows. They all have energy eigenvalues. Their vacuum energy is zero because of supersymmetry. Therefore, you can imagine such a state on the right-hand side of this room, vacuum number one, on the left-hand side, vacuum number two, and then there is a domain wall which separates between them. This is known from condensed matter. For instance, in ferromagnets, this is a common phenomenon that domains with different orientation of magnetization are separated by a transitional domain, which is called domain wall. There are special features, however, because of course, in strongly coupled field theory, nobody was able to calculate, even in condensed matter, if the coupling was strong, nobody was able to calculate the tension of this wall. In this theory, which I mentioned, because of the central charge, I will show in the next transparency the exact formula for the domain wall tension. But now I want to explain why central charges are now Komargotsky and Zarberg suggested to rename them into brain charges. For this reason, you see the new central charges, which occur only mostly because of the anomalies. One of these with two Lorentz indices in the symmetric representation. This is 1.0.1/2 plus 1.0.1 plus 1.0 central charge. So this tensor, Z alpha beta, is like the tensor of the electromagnetic field, right? It's E and B, electric field and magnetic field. This was discovered in 96 by Dvalia and myself. And then another important central charge, which has the Lorentz properties. You see here Q bar alpha dot, Q beta. The central charge has also the two Lorentz indices over the four vector alpha dot beta. So both of them are transformed by Lorentz rotations. No, they are not scalars. And this was discovered, you know, surprisingly only in 2000. And moreover, there was a general classification of central charges created by or worked out by Sergio Ferrara. And he just calculated how many central charges you can in various theories. And he concluded that he just missed this one. He thought that it can be included into the energy momentum tensor, but in fact, it is not. So that's why it was only discovered in 2000 by Gorsky and myself. Now I go to this equation for domain walls. This is the exact expression for the tension of the domain walls. You see it's proportional to the differences of the gliena condensates in neighboring vacua. You don't have to have neighboring vacua, but for the neighboring vacua, it's the minimal domain wall. And in turn, the gliena condensates have been calculated exactly in mid-80s. This is the expression for the gliena condensate. You see it has a phase and different phases and different vacua. And here you have just n lambda cubed. So if you take here the difference, then you see that the tension is proportional to n. It was not obvious a priori why it's proportional to n. You have n here, but you have 1 over n and the difference of these two condensates, and there is an overall factor n in the coefficient. It was unexpected because usually solitons would have the tension proportional to n squared, but here it turned out because of this exact result is proportional to n, and Witten immediately noted it looks like the tension for the brain, not for the standard domain wall as a soliton. Brain tension is proportional 1 over coupling constant, not 1 over coupling constant squared. And that's probably the reason why Kumar Gotsky decided to, or suggested to call this brain charges. Okay, this wall is 1/2 BPS saturated. What does it mean? It means that out of 4 supercharges, 2 combinations act on this wall trivially. They are annihilated. Now, another interesting feature of the supersymmetry, that this wall interpolating between vacuum 1 and 2, or n minus 1 and n, is not a unique wall. In fact, there are 10 distinct, well, not 10, I'm sorry, n distinct walls which produce interpolation between n distinct minimal walls interpolating between a given pair of vacua. So this somehow repeats, right? Okay, here it is written. The walls itself are degenerate. There are n degenerate vacua, but for a given pair of vacua, you can have n degenerate walls. This was shown by Acharya and Wafa from string consideration, and then it was shown by Ritz, myself, and Weinstein directly in field theory, in particular this field theory. Well, it's deformations, which means that there is a completely novel object which never was tried previously or studied. You can have a composite wall. For instance, here you see on the right hand side you have vacuum 1, on the left hand side vacuum 2, but the walls which separate them, like here, there are three distinct, what is written, three distinct walls, wall 1, wall 2, and wall 3. They have, all of them have one and the same BPS tension, but they are separated from a domain line which is attached to the domain wall. Okay? So it's a new phenomenon. The domain line central charge in this case is non-holomorphic, and therefore you cannot calculate the tension of the domain wall. And moreover, by changing the parameters of the model, you can observe various phase transitions in these domain lines. Okay, in the remaining 5 minutes, I see that everybody is tired already, but I want just to tell, I will skip all more technical things and will tell just an interesting results which appear in case when you have 1/2 central charge, which is usually non-holomorphic, but in certain instances it can be holomorphic. That's an overlook which Ferrara made, because P and Z, if Z exists, they have to be orthogonal to each other, so you cannot include Z in the definition of the energy moment. These central charges are relevant to the vortex strings, and we all in everyday life or in our world, we know many examples. For instance, here is an example of a vertex which exists forever exists in one of the lakes in a national park in the US, never disappears. Tornado, which you see sometimes on TVs, is also of this type. It is something which winds around around an axis. Okay. That's a physical phenomenon of the first such object, of the first vortex string, which I already mentioned. It's due to Abrikosov, Alexey Abrikosov, who predicted that it will exist in superconductors. In superconductors is the Cooper pair condensate. So if you put long solenoids inside the superconductor, because Cooper pairs are charged, all electric fields are screened inside the superconductor, but magnetic charges cannot be screened. Long solenoid, these have North Pole. no South Pole, this has North Pole. So the magnetic lines emanating from the these solenoids cannot spread all over the surface because, as you know, magnetic field suppresses Cooper pair condensation. So, but they cannot terminate anywhere. So the only solution suggested by Abrikosov that they squeeze into a thin, narrow tube, into a narrow tube with constant cross section. Inside the tube, superconductivity exists lost. You lose some energy. However, you save yourself from a larger loss of energy, larger disaster. This is called, it occurs in QED. It's an abelian example. It's called the Abrikosov string, which was written in relativistic theory by Nielsen and Dollison. It is interesting that Abrikosov obtained this string solution in superconductors and invented superconductors of the second kind. One is his first grad student work. It was 1954. He was Landau's student. He showed this work to Landau, and Landau highly disliked him. Not him, maybe him too, I don't know, but he disliked his work and told him not to publish it. So Abrikosov put it into his drawer, and it was just resting in a drawer for 2 years when Landau somehow relaxed and gave his okay for publication. So the paper appeared in 1956, and it was Abrikosov got for this particular work in 2003 the Nobel Prize. So he was lucky that Landau didn't order to destroy the paper completely. Okay, so, but now our task is to invent a non-abelian generalization of the vortex string in superconductor. For Abrikosov string in superconductors, they are abelian. We want a non-abelian generalization, so we take an appropriate in 4 dimensions, an appropriate super Young-Mills theory with matter, with some work and squarks. Unfortunately, I have to omit this part about this theory and about what happens, and only formulate the result. What happens on the non-abelian strings, in addition, you see Abrikosov string is characterized only in its position in this space. On non-abelian strings, there are additional moduli. For instance, in the simplest one, you have unit vectors living at every vectors in the internal isotopic space. They live at every point of the strings, and they oscillate. They are coupled to each other. So this is the so-called SU2 divided by one, by U1. Which is CP1 or O3-sigma model. O3-sigma model was invented by Heisenberg in 1930s for the description of ferro or anti-ferromagnetics. It is also strongly coupled. It is asymptotically free like UCD, but it has a great virtue. And this great virtue, because it's two-dimensional and because of it is two-dimensional, it is exactly solvable. It's one of the two-dimensional models which were exactly solved. So what happened next? I omit everything. In this model, in O3-sigma model, there is an object called kink, because in O3 supersymmetric sigma model, there are 2 vacua. They are degenerate because of supersymmetry, and they can go one into another through a transition, which is called kink. You see this kink, 2 distinct strings, non-abelian string are attached to him, to this kink. And this is Litkov-Polyakov monopole in the Georgi-Glashow model. It seems that there is absolutely no connection between them. This is a 2-dimensional object. This is a 4-dimensional object. The magnetic field here emanates from the center and goes in a Coulomb-like manner. And here you have magnetic lines which are squeezed into the flux tube. So at first sight, you might say that they are like Earth and sky or whatever, absolutely different. It turns out, I have unfortunately no time to explain, that's not so difficult to explain, that in fact, they are completely two-dimensional object is related to this seemingly completely different object in four dimension by a simple analytic continuation of some rather simple functions. And this is the power of supersymmetry. So I give what I have time to give. I have time to give, and using this, we obtained this formula, which was, of course, confirmed later on, that this is the mass of the two-dimensional kink. This is the mass of the four-dimensional Tkov-Polyakov monopole as a function of the scale parameter lambda, which can be lambda 4D QCD or lambda 2D Heisenberg model. They have one and the same lambda in this theory. And mu are also different parameters in the 2D. This is a twisted, so-called twisted mass, and in 4D, it is a certain value of the of the super partner to the n equal 2 super partner to the of the field. It has a condensate in this theory. So, but if mu we know, make a notation that mu is either one or the another, analytic expression which gives you the value of the masses as a function of lambda divided by mu is exactly the same. In two dimensions, for a two-dimensional object attached to two strings, and in four dimensions with a Tkov-Polyakov monopole, which produces the magnetic field emanating in the bulk in a Coulomb-like manner. It's like if you have a Dewar flask and you know that inside there is something very complicated but very difficult to deal with empirically, but you can measure the distributions of the vapor on the surface, outside surface of this Dewar flask. If you measure this distribution, you would automatically know what happens inside. It's a very strong statement, probably one of the strongest statements in this second mission of supersymmetry. And I come to my conclusions. This is another object which you can make again with exactly known. It's called boojum. Boojum comes, it's a word used in condensed matter. You see, it's a junction between a string, a wall, string-wall junction called boojum, which comes from Lewis Carroll's children's book. I skip this too. It's a beautiful object. Everything is calculable, but okay. And this is my conclusion. This is the timeline of the development, starting from my mid earlier developments. I start from 1994, Zyberg-Witten solution. Then 96, 2004, BPS domain walls, lines with exactly known tensions and multiplicities. 2003, invention of non-abelian strings. And then 2003 till present is supersymmetry applied at strong coupling. BPS string, Kinman and Poles, exact results in 2D, 4D. Correspondence, and now applications went even further because there appeared new applications of these ideas in condensed matter and some other applications in the sigma models, which were studied in the 60s and 70s, but many things have been overlooked at that time. And even people can see, think, okay, people already achieved decreasing the degree of supersymmetry from 8 supercharges to 2 supercharges. Still, some interesting results are obtained. Of course, the goal or the dream may be decreasing supersymmetry to nothing, n equal to 0 and obtain some exact results for non-supersymmetric theories. However, here not much is, was done so far, so it's obviously the task for young people. Maybe somebody got interested, and maybe something interesting will come out of that. Thank you very much for listening to me so attentively, and I'm sorry for 5 minute or 6 minute delay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this nice talk. Do we have some questions? There are no questions so far. I would be interested, what do you think, how close are we to solving the confinement problem without any supersymmetry?
In QCD-like theories.
And which would be the direction that is promising?
You know what we already achieved? We achieved in, first of all, in hot QCD, it was possible to solve in a similar way the theory in QCD in the regime of high temperatures or high chemical potentials, which is, of course, a kind of a side topic, but still it is interesting. Now, what have we achieved in this direction in QCD, just no supersymmetry QCD? Unfortunately, not too much, but still we were, first of all, we are able to diminish supersymmetry from n equal 2 to n equal 1. So that's not so difficult. What is really difficult to dualize the theory, you see? We still, what we obtain, although we obtain non-abelian strings, but these non-abelian strings confine not quarks, but monopoles. Zyberg and Witten, because they obtained abelian string for abelian QED, the dualization process from magnetic field to electric field is possible. It's known, in fact, even in supersymmetric version. So they managed to do the dualization. In our case of non-abelian string so far, although some steps are done, but we didn't manage to achieve to, we don't know for non-abelian string how to dualize everything electric into everything magnetic and vice versa. So we do have confining strings, but for different objects.
There would be a last question. So I just know that from ADC, for example, one ADCFT, one tries to compute some experimentally observable quantities, for example, for the gluon plasma. I was just wondering, are there some similar achievements here that one could actually take?
Yeah, there is only one achievement which can be tested, which can and was tested, and test was quite successful, but only in one case. I mentioned here that in super young meals, people, the gluino condensate has been calculated exactly. Gluino condensate is in fact in structure, it looks very similar to quark condensate in QCD. The only difference that gluinos are fermions in the joint representation, while in QCD we have fundamental representations. Quarks are fundamental in the fundamental representation. Now the question is whether or not you can reduce somehow a fundamental representation into the joint representation. And surprisingly, this is the only success of the theory. Surprisingly, this is possible through a chain of tricks, which, okay, what do you do? Gluina is color adjoint, right? Ij, where I is the color index, and I and j run from 1 to n, and then there is the constraint trace lambda is equal to zero. It's traceless. This matrix is traceless. Now, what is possible? Now, if n is large, n goes to infinity, it turns out that the Gluino field ij inside the loops behaves itself exactly as two index antisymmetric representation of SUN. Corrections to this correspondence are suppressed by 1 over n. Okay? But if so, let's observe that at n equal to 3, two index antisymmetric representation is the same as the fundamental. It has three components, it's the same as fundamental representation. So you can introduce several quarks, of course, several Gluino-like particles here. First, go to large n, obtain the prediction for psi bar psi at large, where psi are fundamental at large n. And then if you are in terms of lambda squared, which as you know is known exactly, and then if you are courageous enough or obnoxious enough, I don't know, you set n equal to 3 and you obtain the standard quark condensates, which are known. They are known from two sources, from chiral perturbation theory, also they are known from very extensive lattice calculations. So you have, and they agree, lattice calculation agree with the error bars with the chiral perturbation theory. So at least you have one experimental number which you can compare with something theoretically calculable, let us Gluino condensate. Then of course, okay, and I should say that numerically it's an okay comparison. I mean, it maybe have 30 or 25% disagreement, but it's natural because it's up to 1 over n. This transition has corrections 1 over n. But of course, we don't know these corrections. So, of course, still, we don't know these corrections and we don't know the coefficient in front of this correction. So the reliability of this calculation is not very high, but it is encouraging. It means that it's not complete stupidity to do such things, starting from some exact results in super young mills to obtain results, some at least results for QCT.
Okay, so this is
another
question. Not then, yeah, let's thank you again.
Thank you.